You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with a Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeba, Daniele Freebarincini.
Say you, say me. Lionel, Richie, how's it going?
Oh, wow. We're going back in time with this. Not to the 80s, but 80s? 5 years or so
ago. Yeah, I suppose
that
was 80s.
Well, this was your signature about 3 or 4 years ago, Daniel.
Was it?
You resurrected it.
Did I string it along for more than one episode?
You've never sung before. In the podcast. This is a new one. Obviously inspired by Francois Thomaso.
Not as good as Francois singing. Is it?
Maybe I'm starting to feel territorial. Maybe I'm starting to get insecure. Does he do any Motown, Francois? He's more chanson française, isn't it?
Yeah, lounge singer, isn't he? Yeah. A lounge lizard, Francois.
How are you both? Daniel, what have you been up to? Because I know you've been up to something exciting.
I've just been. I'm in Mallorca still this week, Rich. Lovely weather here. One bit of news: a chance encounter with, of all people, John Degenkolb at the weekend.
A new feature in the podcast: lunch with Daniel.
Yeah,
John.
Yeah. Oh, now John, who's feeling Degenkolb territorial?
I was. I'd been for a bit of a hike, a bit of a sort of trek in the Tramontana Mountains in Mallorca, and I was having lunch at a famous restaurant for English listeners, UK listeners. There is a restaurant called Es Verger, and it's halfway up the hill mountain above Alaró, on which is perched the castle, the old ruin of the castle in Alaró. Anyway, this restaurant is about halfway up, and it became famous in the UK because Rick Stein, the TV chef, featured it in a program, and he said that the lamb he ate there was the best lamb he'd ever tasted. Anyway, I've been there a couple of times. There I was on Saturday around about lunchtime, and who should rock up but Big John. Degger go, as I think he calls himself on social media. And we had lunch.
Was that your reaction when he walked in?
Well, we had lunch, and he was doing a bit of sort of secret groading because this restaurant, it sits sort of at the end of a 3 or 4 kilometer sort of hairpinned gravel road or pretty much unmade road, potholed road, and he told me he'd never been up there, and he was just sort of curious. He'd seen the sign.
So describe the scene that he walks in. He goes,
well, I was sitting outside.
Okay, so he rocks up, he clocks you, he goes, hey, Daniele Freebarincini.
It was very much like that. He said, what a coincidence, what are you doing here? And pulled up a table. He had some lovely sopa mayor.
Share a lamb leg.
No,
together.
he was very inquisitive about the lamb, though. He was sort of asking me every 2 or 3 minutes, so how is the lamb, how does it compare to the last time you had it? Who is this TV chef of which you speak so warmly? But John didn't go for the lamb. He went for sopa mallorquina, which is another local dish. It's sort of a slow-cooked cabbage and bread soup. He was sort of smacking his lips, said it was quite delicious. He was there at the weekend because... I think he was ill the previous week, and it should have been racing last weekend, but because of the illness, couldn't do that, and was having some time out in Mallorca training. But we didn't talk about cycling much. Sorry, chaps.
Did you converse in German or English?
We did a bit of German, a bit of English, mainly English.
How was the lamb?
It was good, napalm. You'll probably get out to Mallorca at some point in the next year or two, won't you? I would recommend you go to Es Verger.
I've seen that episode of Rick Stein's program. And I know.
You?
I remember. Yeah, it's on. It is on a list.
I mean, he likes everything, though, doesn't he, Rick Stein? He likes everything.
Nothing wrong with that, Richard.
he smacks his lips and says, "Oh, delicious, wonderful."
Well, it's a fairly sort of ramshackle place, Esverger. It's a bit of it's kind of like a scout hut. It reminds me of where I used to get changed before sort of Cub football matches. It's a bit bish bash bosh. You know, hundreds of people in there in any given lunchtime. It's a bit of a sort of local institution now.
Rick Stein actually just done a program touring around France and starting in Brittany, working his way down to Provence, and he stopped off in Troyes and tucked into some andouillette and even watched it being made.
I know,
and he was smacking his lips about the andouillette.
Yeah. I mean, what an idiot! I mean, it's disgusting stuff. Well, I must admit,
I think it might have been andouillette 4 A's after it. To indicate the quality
that it's absolutely disgusting as opposed to just awful.
You are still listening to the cycling podcast
anyway.
Well, this has been an unconventional start to the podcast in which we discuss who might finish second at the Giro d'Italia later this year, behind Remco Evenepoel, that is. Lionel, there has been a lot of racing. Do you want to give us a little news roundup?
Loads of racing. Yeah, well, we'll talk about the racing, won't we? But as you say, Remco Evenepoel, his season is off to a flyer. He won a couple of stages at the Tour of the Algarve, which gave him the overall victory. Well, he held off what looked like a full-blooded pursuit by Max Schachmann, but Schachmann was never going to get on terms on the climb up to the finish of stage two. Evenepoel then won the time trial on the final day ahead of world champion Rowan Dennis. So the top three in the south of Portugal, Evenepoel, Schachmann and Miguel Angel Lopez, who won one of the stages. We'll talk about Evenepoel. Is he the new Eddie Merckx? Well, Richard's already convinced he's going to win the Giro.
Better.
Well, I mean, we'll come on to that. Meanwhile, in Spain, the south of Spain at the Ruta del Sol, Astana, Jakob Fuglsang having a good week, his first week racing this season, won the opening stage as we commentated live more or less on it, didn't we, in last week's podcast. He also won stage three. Bahrain McLaren were on his coattails on all of the uphill stages. They had strength in numbers in the top six overall, but Fuglsang won ahead of Jack Haig of Australia and Mitchelton Scott, who also picked up a stage win. So Fuglsang a minute ahead of Jack Haig, Mikel Landa of Bahrain McLaren in third, and his teammates Dylan Teuns and Peo Bilbao in fifth and sixth. The Tour des Alpes Maritimes et du Var, not a great race name, that really, is it? It's a bit of a mouthful. I preferred the Tour du Haut Var, but I suppose if the local authorities are partly contributing to hosting the race, then the Alpes Maritimes need some recognition in there as well. Another overall victory and stage win for Nairo Quintana, winning on the Col d'Ais, which of course will feature in the Tour de France later on this summer. Nice story on the final stage on Montferrand, the charming little climb that rises up above Toulon. Julien Bernard of Trek Segafredo won the stage there. His father, Jean-François Bernard, won stages of Paris-Nice there in 1986 and 87. And in 1992, took the white jersey of Paris-Nice on the climb just a couple of days before his son Julien was born. Julien Bernard's first professional win as well. So his emotion as he crossed the line, understandable. Quintana won overall ahead of Romain Bardet and Richie Porte. The UAE Tour is underway. Pascal Ackermann got his second win of the year on stage one. Caleb Ewan won at Hatter Dam for the second time in a row with a really powerful sprint, catching and passing Sam Bennett on the final 50 or 75 metres to the line. And earlier on today, as we speak, Tuesday, Adam Yates has really laid down a marker in the first leg of the Jebel Hafit double. They'll be racing there again in a couple of days' time. But Adam Yates winning by over a minute from Tadej Pogacar. Unless something dramatic happens, he's in the driving seat to win the UAE Tour overall. Chris Froome's back in action there. Dropped on the climb so far, but is completing the stages. Long road back for him, of course. The Criterium du Dauphiné route has been unveiled, and for the first time since the very first edition in 1947, there's no time trial in the route at all. The last time there wasn't an individual time trial was back in 1961. Well, that was the year that Brian Robinson won, but there was a team time trial that year. So a bit of a break from the usual format for the Dauphiné, which is to mostly start with a prologue time trial or a short time trial and then have a decent length time trial somewhere in the middle. But no, just 8 road stages and a very hilly course as well, Daniel.
It is incredibly hilly, but it's going to be exciting, isn't it? With, well, presumably time bonuses being quite important, no time trial. And the Dauphiné has swung wildly from about less than 10 years ago. The Dauphiné still had 50-kilometre time trials, didn't it? Which was completely skewed the result in favour of the time trialists. I'm thinking of the year when Bradley Wiggins won, 2011. I think there was a very long time trial then, and really for a few editions before that, there was always a very long time trial.
Well, we actually had a question about stage race formats on Twitter this week as well, didn't we, Daniel? It was from Jacob, and he was following up on my talk of the Tour de France returning to national team format. Never going to happen, of course, but I was just speculating about the strength of the Colombians when it comes to the Tour de France. And he's wondering why there couldn't be a week-long Olympic stage race based on national teams and completely points-based, including King of the Mountains, intermediate sprints and points for winning stages, all adding up a bit like a road omnium, he says. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a cracking idea for several reasons. And one, you know, we know how important it is for the host city of an Olympics to kind of show off the country, the geography. A multiple day event would enable them to do that. Also, I've sort of thrown out this wild idea in the past of Grand Tours being sort of determined on a team basis, or the team classification being the most important thing in Grand Tours. That it's not something that's likely to happen, but it would help communicate to sort of the lay public how important teamwork is in cycling. In the Olympics, you would have the issue, which you have in the Olympics anyway, of trade teams and their interests and the national team's interests possibly being at cross purposes. But I think it'd be really entertaining.
Is this the suggestion to replace the road race, or in addition to?
I don't know. Jacob didn't specify, but it's unlike.
I like the concept. I like the concept. I mean, it's
kind of
like an extended Hammer series, isn't it? In a way.
Yeah, I do think that although it's a pretty conservative thing that ASO are doing with the Dauphiné. I mean, it's not exactly radical to have a stage race just without a time trial. I do think it gives a completely different complexion to the race. And I think that overall, the week-long stage races, all being a kind of same flavour of racing, it doesn't lend itself to any one event being sort of too distinct from another. I mean, even in this period of the season now, when really the sort of the GC riders are kind of split into quarters, aren't they? There's you know, there's multiple different events in different parts of the world going on. They're not all head to head yet. That will come later on as the races increase in significance. And then, the theory is that the best of the best go head to head at the Tour de France. I just think that it would be in all of our interests, really, if the stage races were mixed up a little bit. Different formats, different styles of racing, have a team stage race at some point during the season. I think there's there's quite a lot of potential for somebody to give their event a unique flavour. But the problem is that everything is all kind of, we're so kind of wedded to the idea that the lowest aggregate time means the best rider of the race. And well, it's a bit like the issue with golf tournaments, Daniel, isn't it? The whole season is all stroke play, apart from maybe the, you know, one or two match play tournaments. And yet in golf, there are loads of different formats that could be played, but the convention is, and the what the sponsors want is a stroke play tournament. And I suspect that's broadly the same with stage races as well. People don't want to be the kind of the associated perhaps with something that might be seen initially as gimmicky.
Yeah, I mean, we've said before about the Hammer series, haven't we, that I think their issue with the sort of established cycling public has been to get people to watch it once, and once they've watched it once, they actually enjoy it and they sort of appreciate the format. But people do have a tendency to sort of turn their nose up as soon as they detect any kind of gimmickry.
Just to wrap up the news then, some breaking news today is that HSBC is pulling out of its sponsorship deal of British cycling after the Olympic Games in Tokyo later on this year, or rather at the end of 2020, which is 4 years into the eight-year deal. There was a break clause in the contract halfway through, and HSBC is exercising its right to take that break midway through the sponsorship deal. We gather it's due to refocusing its UK marketing efforts, and the British Cycling search will be on for a new sponsor from 2021.
Any more intel on that, chaps? What's going on there? I mean, what did HSBC hope to get from that sponsorship? What did they think they were getting when they signed on?
I think as well as an association with the British Cycling Olympic riders, there was also the participation scheme, trying to get 2 million people cycling by the end of 2020. And British Cycling released a statement to say that they're on course to exceed that milestone. I'm always, you know, the numbers of people on riding bikes, you know, I've never really dug into exactly how they're measuring these figures, but it's certainly, British Cycling has always sold its sponsorship based on an association with the Olympic team riders, but also a strong bid to get people riding bikes, and participation being the key. And I suspect that was what was appealing to HSBC at the start. Once the Olympic Games in Tokyo are over, you could argue that basically the sponsorship has reached a point where it's exhausted the benefits it's going to get. And so, you know, if there's a break clause halfway through, you know, another four years is actually quite a long time in the world of sponsorship, isn't it?
And what's become apparent is that there's a sort of glut of champion cyclists and diminishing returns for them. Certainly, I was speaking to Callum Skinner a couple of weeks ago, who did win an Olympic gold medal in Rio, and he was talking about Olympic gold medalists who cannot get sponsorship deals. There are just too many of them. I mean, you know, in the 2000s, you know, the likes of Chris Hoy and Victoria Pendleton had huge profile and sponsorship deals because they were so unusual, and they were sort of pioneers in a way, and it's been very hard for the athletes coming behind them to follow them. And there's just a general sort of malaise around track racing, I think, at the moment. This is a global phenomenon. I guess Britain was unusual in that track racing was very popular for a while. But the track world championships are about to get underway, aren't they? And nobody seems that interested.
Well, it's inevitable, I suppose, isn't it? That first generation, as you said, Rich, Chris Hoy, Victoria Pendleton, Bradley Wiggins, Mark Cavendish, Geraint Thomas, of course, you know, they really hoovered up the media attention. It was a fresh, brand new story at the time, and the subsequent generations, how can they exceed the achievements of the people who have gone before them? And when you look at the British cycling lineup at the moment, no doubting that there are some absolutely excellent performers, but in terms of breaking into the sort of mainstream consciousness and becoming sort of the bankable stars of sport, not just of cycling, really, Laura Kenny is the bankable star, isn't she? And there's not a great deal else that kind of captures the imagination in quite the same way. I do also, although I gather the publicity around Dr. Richard Freeman and all of the You know, the Bradley Wiggins Fancy Bears hack is not a factor in HSBC's decision. It's inevitable that people will draw that conclusion from this news today, I guess.
Isn't there also, chaps, in the wider context, problems, you could call them that, or certainly strategic changes that HSBC is undergoing as a company?
Well, there are certainly job losses on quite a large scale at HSBC. So in that context, it's obviously, you know, often marketing activity that gets cut as well, isn't it? So maybe not a surprise.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can still get your 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. That's SISCP25. Just before we go on to talk about Remco Evenepoel, Corrections Corner, quickly from last week, we had a message from a listener called Theo Gegenhart, who's pointed out that our discussion last week about the new UCI rule that allows development team riders to ride for World Tour teams, it's actually been done already this season by Jumbo Visma in Provence and Israel Startup Nation at the Herald Sun Tour. So there we go. So Jake Stewart for Groupama FDJ last weekend wasn't the first. Thank you for that, Theo. Do keep listening, even though we occasionally make errors. Now, we're going to talk a bit about how coronavirus might affect the racing. It's a developing story in Italy, really, and football matches have been cancelled. Bike races may well be under threat, and there's some big ones there in the next few weeks. But before we get on to that, the racing that has been run, well, Remco Evenepoel in Algarve was really the standout performance, wasn't it? It was. I mean, he's ridden two stage races this season, won both of them, and he's 20 years old. You know, first year as a pro last year, he had a very good year. I think most of us imagined, for all his phenomenal talent, that it would take him 2 or 3 years to find his feet as a professional, because he's not even been racing his bike for that long. But he is quite the phenomenon, isn't he? And he said in Algarve that he's not quite at his best, that he's got a couple of kilos to lose before the Giro. And you do wonder what his ambitions will be going into the Giro.
Yes, Rich, very impressive. And I'm still sort of struggling to wrap my head around it, really. Just, you know, based on his sort of physiology, there's nothing sort of remarkable. There's nothing that stands out. He's quite short. He doesn't particularly look like a sprinter, a time trialist, or a climber. Just kind of very average build, and just the kind of coincidence of what seems to be a bit of a genetic freak coming from the absolute sort of cradle of professional cycling in the world. You know, it's not as if the Belgians have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to be the best bike riders in the world. You know, professional cycling has existed for just over 100 years. And the sort of gene pool has become, we've often said this, in the last 15 or 20 years has become a lot wider. And that sort of, you would think, would reduce the odds, if a freak, a new sort of freak did appear, reduce the odds of him coming from somewhere like Belgium, in a sport where, you know, physiology and you know, someone's genetic makeup are absolutely key. You know, it's primarily a physiological exercise riding a bike. So, I think it's quite astounding, really. I think there's a danger that you know, people expect him to win absolutely everything he competes in. Yet, I don't think we've seen him really beat the best in the high mountains. Well, we certainly haven't yet. His references in the high mountains are pretty slim, not least because he's not really raced much in the high mountains. He's pretty new to cycling. You know, 4 or 5 years ago he was still playing football and thought he was going to be a professional footballer. And even as an amateur, you know, he didn't do a lot of the big mountainous races, the Val d'Aosta, the Rond de l'Isard in France, and these races where we usually see someone's credentials in the mountains. But, you know, I wouldn't put anything past him in the Giro.
I should point out, I'm being facetious when I suggest that he's going to win the Giro. He's not really ridden anything like the climbs that he will ride at the Giro. But you know, you do watch him, and especially in a time trial, you know, which is, you talk about cycling being a test of physiology. I guess time trial, the race of truth, it's the ultimate test of just pure ability. And to beat Rohan Dennis in the way he did, to catch Dan Martin as he almost did, and he's so impressive looking. I mean, he is a small guy, surprisingly strong in the time trial. A contender, I would think, for the Olympic time trial gold in Japan. And he does appear to have the ability to ride uphill too. So, you know, looking a bit further down the road, there don't seem at the moment to be any limits. I guess the unusual thing about him being a Belgian is that his skill set is not the typical Belgian skill set, in that the one race he might struggle on is, say, you know, Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, because he doesn't look like the sort of rider who would excel on the cobbled stretches or the cobbled climbs. He's just too small for that. But you know, it's a long time since Belgium has had a Grand Tour contender, really. And 1979 was the last Belgian Grand Tour win, wasn't it, Lionel? That was the subject of your friend's special a couple of years ago. 78, sorry. The Pink Panther. At the Giro, yeah. So, you know, I think he looks, you know, just on paper, and if you study his results and look at his performances, he looks like he might develop into a Grand Tour contender, certainly.
I think just to add very quickly, Napalm, before you come in, the other amazing thing, given the number of races he's already won, is that he hasn't really won many in any kind of sprint. That's another area where we don't really know how good he is. You know, I suspect that he's a guy who will win out of sort of 15-man groups and 20-man groups fairly regularly, but we haven't really seen that. He hasn't needed to do that yet.
Yeah, I'm with you, Daniel, in not really being able to place this start to the season in any kind of context. I mean, the Vuelta a San Juan that he won last month, or rather finished at the very start of this month, sorry, it's a pre-season friendly, isn't it? I don't want to damn it with faint praise, but it's not necessarily an indicator of coming.
How about damning it with outright insult?
But it's not an indicator of a potential Grand Tour victory, is it? Really, it's an early season race where the field is not that deep. And yes, he won it won it impressively. Algarve is slightly different in that certainly the last 10 years it's enjoyed a real really stepped on from being quite a sort of. It was a small race, wasn't it? Very important for the Portuguese peloton, but not really a race that attracted a big field of stars. But really, since Alberto Contador's win in 2009, it's become an early season pointer. Victories in the last 10 years, Richie Porte, Michał Kwiatkowski, a couple of wins for Geraint Thomas, Primoz Roglic as well. Pogacar won it last year. It's a race where, you know, you're going to get a decent field. But as I said at the start of the podcast, the peloton is really split across four fronts at the moment. And it's really hard to kind of place these results into any kind of context until you see how Evenepoel gets on against a stronger field in a more difficult race. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the talk about is he the new Eddie Merckx? I mean, Eddie Merckx won Milan-San Remo in his first full season as a professional. I know it's comparing completely different eras, but this is not quite the same level, is it? I would say the performance at San Sebastian by Evenepoel was more impressive than winning a sort of week-long stage race in February.
Yeah, I hear you. But Alaphilippe won in San Juan last year, didn't he? And Pogacar won in Algarve. And you know, winning is important. You can only beat the field that you're racing against. And in Algarve, the field is pretty impressive. You know, you mentioned Kwiatkowski there. Guys like him, you might say the race doesn't really matter, but I look at his performance there and think he's in trouble. You know, he's clearly not the rider he was.
Which he actually acknowledged himself, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, you Evenepoel will will be buoyed by his performances, and I'm sure that once he does race against in stronger fields, he'll do pretty well. He's clearly going really well, and I thought his performance to win on the climb was really impressive. I mean, he jumped with about 250 meters to go. It was a perfect move at the perfect moment, and showed something else as well. It was that high end power, you know, that he hasn't won in a sprint yet, but that was kind of the next best thing. Very impressive indeed, I thought. And yeah, who knows what's going to unfold.
Just on the time trial as well, chaps, I mean, that is the one thing, Napalm, with all the caveats, the time trial win over Rowan Dennis, I do find quite extraordinary. I know Dennis has said that, you know, he's saving his best until later in the year. But for a guy who, you know, as I said, wasn't cycling a few years ago, you think of all of the sort of years of honing equipment, technique, and the mental discipline of time trialing that someone like Rowan Dennis has undergone, and other sort of dominant time trialers before him. It took them a few years in general to sort of reach the top. Yeah, you think of a guy who's come in green like Evenepoel, and you know, he's on a fast bike and he rides for a team who has produced a lot of good time trialists over the last few years. But I find that pretty extraordinary, yeah, I must say.
He's remarkably mature off the bike as well, isn't he? His press interviews are those of a you know, seasoned pro. He's very polished. He speaks well. Very touching tribute to Nicholas Mass's son who was stillborn. Which, you know, again, you know, he speaks like somebody who has been in that position for years with real maturity.
Just looking at his characteristics, what is the biggest race that you sort of speaking today would expect him to win this year? Or you know, he'd be your favourite.
I genuinely think he'll have a similar year to Pogacar last year. And so, you know, Pogacar went on one California. There's no California this year, but Evenepoel could win a race like that. I don't know, a Catalunya or a Tour of Poland, I guess, or you know, something like that. And he could well, if he finishes the Giro, be in quite a high position overall, possibly. But again, we don't know about the high mountains yet, but I could see him having a similar year to Pogacar's.
I think, Richard, you mentioned his temperament and how at ease he seems to be. I think that could be his biggest asset, because when we're talking about him in comparison to somebody like Pogacar, Evenepoel has a what could be a disadvantage in that he's Belgian, and he is going to be in that goldfish bowl of well, we know how kind of demanding the Belgian media can be, and how kind of analytical of performances they can be, and just the breadth of coverage and the level of expectation in a country that is absolutely cycling mad, which is not necessarily something that Pogacar would have to contend with to the same degree. And I suppose I'm certainly not trying to tell anyone that Evenepoel isn't an exciting and potentially fantastic rider. I'm just kind of trying to put a lid on a level of expectation, really. He's still only 20 years old, and I think that, you know, there's a tendency, isn't there, to crown somebody the new Eddie Merckx. And I know we've done it kind of tongue-in-cheek here, but even 3 years is a long time in professional cycling, and in 3 years' time, he will still be younger than you know, a lot of riders who have made quite considerable you know, strides into their careers. You know, his contemporaries are kind of going to be 4 or 5 years older than him, just because of the age he is and the progress he's made so far.
And just as one very final note of caution, chaps, as I pointed out to someone on Twitter, I think a few days ago, the Italian Giambattista Baroncelli was 20 in 1974, finished second in the Giro, 12 seconds behind Eddie Merckx, never won a Grand Tour.
Shoot, shoot. suite à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, reminding me to tell you that this week's episode is supported by Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix is the online personal styling service where an expert stylist picks clothes just for you based on your taste, size, and budget. It's really easy. Go to the website, fill out the style quiz about your clothing preferences, shapes, sizes, and what you like to wear. Then it's over to your stylist who'll hand select and send to you 5 items of clothing so you can discover new looks without the effort. They've got loads of great brands available, some well-known ones that you'll have heard of, as well as others you won't have heard of, including their own exclusive items. So you won't have the same shirt on as everyone else. And the best bit is it's just £10, and that's with free delivery and returns. You don't need to subscribe to anything. You can arrange regular deliveries if you like, or you can just order when you want to. You're a customer, aren't you, Lionel?
Well, I am, yeah. I look forward to the delivery.
So I could tell by your style.
Well, I mean, on our recent theatre tour, did you not notice I had a different jacket, had some different trousers? I had a very nice pair of cords, which I would never have picked out if I'd just gone shopping. But when they arrived in my Stitch Fix box, I was like, well, I'll try those on, see how they fit. They fitted really well, and I decided to buy them. So what I've enjoyed about it is that each month you get a selection of things turning up. It's a bit like having a mini Christmas once a month, and then you get to try things on at home without having to be in a sort of cramped changing room in a shop. And well, as you just said, Rich, you can pick and choose, send back the items that don't quite work and keep the ones that do. So I've been very satisfied with my Stitch Fix so far.
Yes, it's an enjoyable experience. I'm a customer too. Get started with Stitch Fix today and support the Cycling Podcast by going to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling right now. That's Stitch Fix, stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. Chaps, before we crack on with the next bit, do you mind if I plug my US shows again?
Not at all, Richard.
New York on April the 8th.
It's like Robbie Williams is going to break America.
April the 9th in Washington, D.C. has been sold out. It's sold out. So we've added a second show in Washington, although I'm told it's not actually in D.C., but Mount Rainier at the Red Dirt Studio. Now, this place has been located and secured for us by Stacey Snyder, our friend, the ceramicist who lives there. So Friday, April the 10th, Washington, D.C. / Mount Rainier. A second event with Ian Boswell, me in conversation with Ian Boswell. For tickets for that show or New York, a couple of nights earlier in Rafa in New York, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and look forward to meeting a lot of you there. Now, Lionel, what's the latest on your Next Friends special? We released at the weekend to commemorate the 90th birthday of Jean Bobet, a special from a couple of years ago when I went to visit him, the brother of Louise on Bobet. A rider who raced with Fausto Coppi, Jacques Anquetil, and all the other stars from that era. So we released that on Saturday, so that's in the feed for anybody who's signed up as a friend of the podcast recently. And we've got your Jani Brajkovic special coming out soon, I think.
Well, just firstly, on your Jean Bobet special, we don't have a culture of praising each other in public, do we, Richard?
No, certainly not.
Absolutely not. But when I first listened to that episode, it was such a charming conversation. If you haven't signed up as a friend of the podcast yet out there in listener land, do so at thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. As for my interview with Jani Brajkovic, Slovenian rider who I went to see in Novo Mesto in Slovenia a few weeks ago, that's edited and ready to go. So look out for that on the Friends of the Podcast feed imminently.
A lot coming, isn't there? We've got that going out. We've got Service Course going out this week, which is Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley looking at what the pros are riding in 2020. Lizzie's already been racing this year. Now, we were going to talk about coronavirus, which is certainly a developing story and one that is getting quite close to home and close to some major bike races with an outbreak in Italy, which is causing quite a lot of panic at the moment, and could affect Strade Bianche, which isn't in the area at the moment, but Milan-San Remo certainly is, Trofeo Binda is, the Women's World Tour race, is right in the epicenter of it, actually. And, you know, further afield, there's even talk of the Giro even being under threat. Maroveni's spoken about this. There's really nothing he can do about it. But we've seen major football matches postponed. You know, we don't really have any insight on this at all. We'll just have to watch and see what happens, I think, over the next few days, won't we?
Yeah, the situation is obviously escalating, Rich, in Italy. Seven people have died now. We're talking on Tuesday. You know, situation's changing all the time. But the seven people have died are all in their sort of 60s, 70s and 80s, all ill to some degree before they got the virus. But there are 12 town councils now that have completely shut themselves off. And the sort of epicenter, the first, I think, town to sort of shut itself off, quarantine itself, was a place called Codogno, which, if you imagine Italy as the boot, it's sort of just below the knee, and it's actually the birthplace of, do you remember an Italian sprinter called Mario Traversoni in the 90s? The bit of trivia about Traversoni, he was, I don't know if this had ever happened before, but he won a Tour de France stage having finished third, having crossed the line third. The two guys ahead of him were both disqualified. I think it was Jens Heppner was one of them. That was the kind of epicenter, and it's in that's in the Lombardy region. Obviously, Milan is the capital of the Lombardy region. And everything's being sort of managed on a regional level in Italy. And Lombardy is the region that's taken the most stringent measures. And they've cancelled all major sporting events. All sort of school exchanges in Lombardy have been, so foreign students coming to Lombardy, their pupils going abroad, for example, they've all been cancelled until the 15th of March. That gives you an idea of how worried they are about people coming in and out of the region. But as far as Milan San Remo is concerned, obviously starts in Milan. The first 55 to 60 kilometres or thereabouts of the route take place in Lombardy. And then the route goes into Piedmont briefly and then into Liguria. But Venya has already said that they will not, or they're not considering moving the start. You'll remember in 2013, for example, there was a terrible day of where it snowed, didn't it? The weather was awful, and they actually took a big chunk, I can't remember whether it was about 40 kilometres or it might have even have been more, out of the route, and they actually paused the race because of snow and truncated the race. But Venya said it's out of the question that they move the start, take 60 kilometres, the 60 kilometres in Lombardy off the route, and you know, have a shortened Milan-San Remo. So it's looking pretty bleak at the moment, I would say.
I think the issues here are the incubation period for the virus is a couple of weeks, potentially could be even more than that. And the fact that the movement of people is what is exacerbating the spread. And so even if sporting events were going on, really it's the movement of people in and out of the affected regions that are the problem. And so when you consider that a sport like football is has already, they cancelled Serie A matches, and they're talking about playing Inter's Europa League game behind closed doors this week. The priority for the authorities must be to get it under control and stop it spreading further. And the restricting people's movement is presumably going to be key to that. So it's not just about whether or not events can logistically be held, it's whether or not people can get in and out, and whether or not the gathering of large numbers of people, whether it's watching a football match or watching a bike race, is a smart thing to happen while the areas are so affected. So at the moment, it seems to be getting worse hour by hour rather than a lid being put on it and things being contained. So the first bike race that could be affected would be Strada Bianca, men's and women's races, the 7th of March, then Tirreno Adriatico the week after that, and then Milan San Remo the weekend after that. So we'll just have to watch and see, and it really will be out of the control of race organisers and cycling authorities, won't it? It will be down to local and national governments.
I was just thinking, chaps, this week about how the Milan-San Remo route has been altered in the past. And it reminded me of a story, quite a famous story in Italy, that's not strictly speaking linked to Milan-San Remo directly. But I mentioned where, you know, how much of the San Remo course is in Lombardy. So the race transitions into Piedmont, in a, close to a place called Ovada. And that's where the Turchino, the famous first climb of Milan-San Remo, starts. There was actually there was a proposal in the late 70s, which became sort of infamous, to flatten the Turchino, to knock the Turchino, the whole mountain, down. There was a famous show on Italian TV called Portobello. And in the late 70s, a fella came on there, and one of the regular features of this show was sort of regular people come on and suggest solutions to extraordinary problems, or, you know, things that were giving the Italian population, you know, real difficulty. And this chap from Milan, this tram driver, came on and he said, right, I've got a solution to the fog in northern Italy. The fog that, you know, is a real sort of facet of life all across northern Italy. And he said that if we basically open a window onto the Mediterranean Sea, we can get rid of the fog. And the way we do that is we flatten the Turchino. We knock it down. And yeah, this became quite a famous episode in Italian sort of history and cultural life, so much so that it was mentioned in a speech by the president of Lombardy, the Lombardy region, a couple of years ago.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet again to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Lacca, bicycle insurance powered by you, a community of cyclists all joining together to provide insurance cover for your bikes and equipment with lower premiums and speedier settlements in the event that you need to make a claim. Let's hear from one of Lacca's happy customers, Jun Secchi.
I am a co-founder and CTO of a startup called Polk, and I have been with Lacca since 18 September 2018. I choose Lacca simply because of business model. So I was with other insurance provider. I find myself paying a premium price and didn't get much out of that. And then I find out Lacca launching this community-based pricing model, which is very appealing. So you only claim when you had an accident, your bike got stolen, and you know, all the price you've been charged monthly is based on the community, how many claims has been through. So I find that's a very fair model compared to others. The latest incident was my bike got stolen, and then I find out I registered my bike on the stolenride.co.uk, and someone from Poland contacted me saying my bike has been advertising on the Polish website. So I forward those information to the police and to Lacca as well. Jonathan from Lacca, so was helping me to investigating, essentially trace down the thief and providing all the essential evidence to the police. So I think he was being really helpful throughout that process. And the case is still going on, so hopefully I can get my bike back. Also, my other experience with the insurance claim with them are very, very, very convenient. So I simply make a claim, submit all the evidence, record a video, and then they will respond me in 2 or 3 days, and I can get my claims through, either buy a new bike or get a compensation for my stolen bike. Yeah.
So if that sort of bike-specific insurance cover sounds like the sort of cover you'd like for your bikes and equipment, go to lacca.co.uk. That's Lacca, LACA.co.uk, to find out more.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for the Italian races coming up, and indeed for Italy, and hope that the coronavirus does become contained and doesn't spread any further. Although that seems a forlorn hope.
Rich, but, the Italian health minister, who's in the press a lot at the moment, is called Giuseppe Hope, Giuseppe Speranza. So that's a good open, isn't it?
Well, that's a good sign, positive sign. And we'll cling on to whatever we can. Any other business then, chaps? I mean, there's been lots of racing, as we said, and there's a race ongoing at the moment, the UAE Tour, which we watched just before we started recording today, and it was a really phenomenal. I think we were all waiting for Pogacar to light things up, but it was Adam Yates. Took over a minute out of Pogacar and looked very, very good indeed in searing heat that really took its toll on a lot of riders. Alejandro Valverde was well off the pace. James Knox seemed to be suffering in the heat as well, and quite a few other riders too. So the race was really blown apart today, and Pogacar looked good. He'll have another chance up there, of course, but Adam Yates looked exceptional.
Well, we've talked before, haven't we? A couple of weeks ago, I think I mentioned that Pog doesn't like the heat, or certainly
that's right.
Not,
you did,
not as
yeah.
much as he likes the sort of murky, you know, cold. And I guess we saw that today. I mean, I looked at the temperatures and they were around about 28, 29, 30 degrees in Dubai. So, yeah, that may have been a factor, but it's a huge win, isn't it? In the same way that Quintana's win at Mont Ventoux was by a huge margin last week, Adam Yates won by over a minute.
Well, they'll have a chance to do it all over again on Jebel Hafit on Thursday, won't they? Quite like this two-legged affair on the same mountain, a few days apart. This might be something that one of the Grand Tours could do in the future. It's been done in the past, I suppose. They went to Alpe d'Huez twice in 1979, didn't they? A long time ago now. But, yeah, seeing
Tourmalet,
how it plays out.
Tourmalet 2010 in the Tour, but they did opposite sides, didn't
opposite
they?
Sides, yeah. And, of course, in the Dauphiné, they'll be going up to Megève, two different routes on the final weekend. I quite like it. It's interesting.
In 2011, did they not go over the Galibier twice, but on two different
Correct.
Days?
Why do you like it?
On a different sites.
Why do
as well?
I like it? I don't know. I think it because it gives you the opportunity to draw comparisons. Who went well on stage, you know, the first stage, who went well on the second stage. I mean, there is now, Richard alluded to it there, a kind of a revenge match opportunity for Pogacar, isn't there?
When did Pog become Pogacar? I noticed you've been very...
Pogacar. Good question, yeah.
Well, how is it? How is it said?
No.
Pogacar.
I'm just saying
Pog.
That.
Just Pog.
Pog is official... podcast nickname is Pog, isn't it? Anyway.
Is there a system of fines for using his correct full name?
I don't know. I didn't notice that Pog...
He hasn't written a plog about
no,
it, has he?
I didn't notice that Pog was twiddling a fancy little gear on that climb today, whereas Adam Yates was in the big ring most of the time.
So we shall see. I mean, maybe Adam Yates won't need to make quite the same statement second time round because the overall win, well, he's just got to defend now, hasn't he? Yeah. Just got to defend. The race in the south of France, I mean, the Tour des Alpes Maritimes du Var, a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? It used to be called the Tour du Haut Var, didn't it, a few years ago. But some of these races need to think about their marketing a bit more. Perhaps it should. This one should be the Hipsters Criterium
Having
International.
Having said that, I remember I got quite exercised a few years ago when Strada Bianchi became Strada Bianchi. Remember, it started off as Eroica, didn't it?
It did. Yeah,
and I was upset at the time because I really liked it. You know, it's such an unusual name for a race, Eroica. But actually now, well, obviously Strada Bianchi makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
But this little stage race, 3-day race, it's kind of reminiscent of the old Tour of the Mediterranean, reminiscent of Criterium International when it used to be held down in the south of France, or Paris-Nice, regular visitor, of course, to the Col d'Hers and Montferrand, ticking off places that are will really mean something to those of us who grew up following cycling in the 1980s. And as I mentioned at the start, Julien Bernard following in the wheel tracks of his father Jean-Francois this weekend. But the outstanding performance again, Nairo Quintana winning another
Nairo
overall
man.
Classification for Arkea Samsic. And well, we can speculate about why.
Nairo Newman.
And of course, Superman as well. Won a stage in Algarve.
Rode pretty well. And did a decent time trial as well, Superman.
And all these little clues, you know, when these riders start facing off against one another, it's going to be quite interesting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Bring it on. I mean, that's the sort of unintended consequence of the shambles that is the cycling season, is that they're all scattered asunder, and then but it does sort of work, doesn't it? Because you just get these tantalizing titbits, and your imagination does the rest, and then you know, we eventually see them all come together. It begins at sort of Catalonia, doesn't it, and the Basque country a little bit, and then ramps up as we get towards the Giro and then the Tour. But Quintana does look like a new man, doesn't he, really?
Well, he wouldn't have been targeting these kind of races if he was still with Movistar, would he? There's clearly the influence of his new team and sponsor.
And it's and fresh races as well, maybe.
Exactly. A new lease of life for him. Over in Spain at the Ruta del Sol, Bahrain McLaren, having such strength in numbers, certainly caught my eye. Mikel Landa lost out to Fuglsang on the first stage. Peo Bilbao lost out to Fuglsang on the third stage. Landa finished on the podium. But the fact that they had sort of three riders all up there, all riding aggressively, contesting the stages, was, we've not really seen that from Bahrain before. It does look like they're certainly racing, trying to catch the eye a bit more, trying to win stages, trying to make perhaps it's the influence of Rod Ellingworth coming to the fore already.
I think they've got a really good roster, haven't they? They're very versatile roster. I think inheriting a rider like Dylan Teuns is an absolute godsend for anyone coming in like Rod Ellingworth is coming into that role. Teuns is a rider who is getting better, I think, every year. He's quick, he's resilient, he's going to be a massive threat in the Ardennes, and you know, we've seen him in major tours in the last couple of years. Also now, having, you know, for a couple of years been a bit of a nearly man, he's starting to sort of convert the opportunities that he does create for himself, particularly on the steeper climbs.
I think he's on the start list for Omloop Het Nieuwsblad at the weekend, and he had a very good result there last year, didn't he?
He did a bafflingly good result. I think he was fifth, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He was in a move with Stibar, Van Avermaet, Wellens and Lutsenko, so perhaps not a surprise that he finished fifth out of the five, but really was a surprise to see him there.
Who won last year? Was it Stibar
won last year? Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, yeah.
The other, Wellens, I suppose, not someone you would have previously associated with the cobbles either. It was a funny move that, really, the mix of riders in there. Teuns on the start list again this year, and of course this is the start of the season proper this coming weekend, Richard. And you'll be there.
I'll be there, Lionel, heading over that direction on Thursday morning for a special assignment in the morning, and then going to hang around and get Het Nieuwsblad, and then it's sort of ugly sister Kern of Brussels Kern, you know, which very much after the Lord Mayor's parade, isn't it? It's a kind of funny race, but very low key for a race in that area as well. But for that reason, it's great for talking to riders at the start. Het Nieuwsblad's is a mini Tour of Flanders, and it has all the kind of razzmatazz that Flanders has, really. So looking forward to it. Yeah, it should be good.
Just finally, chaps, I missed my cue a few minutes ago when we were talking about race names. Were you guys aware of a race that takes place in Tunisia, or certainly has done, called the International Cycling Tour of the Central Pharmacy? It's a UCI 2.2 race, and I think the last edition was written in 2018, and one of the stars of the show was friend of the podcast, Davide Rebellin.
Definitely one that you want on your palmarès, isn't it, that one?
Slightly,
I think,
unfortunate.
There's been a few unofficial champions of the Tour of the Pharmacy.
If anyone knows more about, or if any of the listeners have been to the International Cycling Tour of the Central Pharmacy of Tunisia, then by all means get in touch and let us know.
Would you say that's your favourite race name, Daniel?
I think so. It takes some beating, doesn't it?
It's certainly up there.
Richard, favourite race name?
Yeah, no, I can't think of anything to beat that at all.
I always used
give me
to...
A week, give me a week to think about
well,
it.
Well, let us know next week. I always used to like the Golden Sporen Tweedaagse in Flanders. The Golden Spurs 2-day.
I thought you said Sporen. I thought that was maybe one Ali Hodge might be targeting.
It's another name for the Tour of Scotland. Yeah, the Golden Sporen. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Sorry, listeners in Scotland. I didn't mean it.
excellent.
More on the... Okay. It's named after the Battle of the Golden Spurs. I think I talked about this in the Lionel of Flanders a few years ago. The Battle of the Golden Spurs was a big deal in Flanders. Took place in and around the area of Kortrijk and was a battle between the Flemish and the French, I think.
Another belter, chaps, was the tour of the Frankfurt Airport. Do you remember that?
The tour of Frankfurt Airport.
What was it called in German?
The rund den Flughafen, den Frankfurter Flughafen. Or no, actually, rund den Flughafen Köln-Bonn. So it's actually, wrong airport. Similar area of Germany, but it was Cologne and Bonn Airport.
For stage one, terminal one to terminal two.
Oh dear. And then a criterium around the baggage reclaim belt. Very tight corners, but great to watch.
No cheating by bunny hopping onto the moving conveyor belt.
Oh dear. We'd really better wrap up for this week, I think, before this veers into the surreal.
Well, before we go this week, and I should say, actually, we've got some big news for the Cycling Podcast in next week's episode, so do tune in for that. But we must say some thanks to friends of the podcast. So for me, a big thank you to Andrew Geddes, Peter Bowden, Will Whitmore, Derek Morgan, Sean Donahue, Bernard McNally, Kyle Doman, Simon Hall, Louis Verne, and Sterling Swaim.
And a big thank you from me to Penelope Economou, Ralph M. Sander, Martin Norris, Mike Longshanks Hetherington, Kevin Moret, Andrew Dickey, Elaine Pearton, Stephen Greer, and Giles Edwards.
And a big thanks from me to someone like myself with Polish origins, by the sound of it, Mark Jarodzewski, Jody Shimoda, Mark Watkins, Jody and Tyler Schwartz. Kevin Rushton, Sharon Chambers, Michael Bushell, Chris Connolly, Jim Terry, and Mark Edmondson.
And also thanks to Francesca Osowska, who I met at the weekend and told me to say thanks to her for being a friend of the podcast in this week's podcast. Thanks, Francesca. Thanks, Daniel. Thanks Lionel.
Guys. Thanks, Richard.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.